Is it safe? What if I change history by stepping on a butterfly or something?
Well, that's not gonna happen, is it? Who steps on a butterfly? You'd literally have to be like, wait, come here, butterfly. Come here, have it. And welcome to the Whovian Review. I'm Michael.
I'm Shelby.
I am Jeremy, that has not stepped on a butterfly.
I am the Jeremy who has stepped on a butterfly.
And I'm Colin, baby.
Space Babies is where we're heading tonight. And my goodness, what an interesting title. Jeremy, take it away with butterflies.
Oh my goodness. Okay, there are points which I love the idea of a fun gag. And the gag itself was fine. And perfectly, I was good with that.
I like dinosaurs. Do you hate dinosaurs, Jeremy?
No, I don't hate dinosaurs. I hate the Doctor being able to have the best spearmint breath on the planet.
No, man, that was the best part of this whole episode was that bit, is I've been saying it for years. Now that the Doctor knows that he's got infinite regeneration energy, we already knew that the Doctor could use that to heal and you know, bring back to life other things, and has just not been using it. So finally, we've got the Doctor uses his regeneration energy to bring a butterfly back to life.
Well, last little creature he brought back, he thought he was knocking 10 years off his life.
And not only that, but he just regenerated, because technically he just regenerated and then had the adventure.
He just regenerate? I don't know.
Well, but
it could still be in the first 15 hours.
We saw Matt Smith's Doctor way, way after regeneration.
I know, I'm just saying, if you had to go back to old school Doctor Who trope, where they said, well, within 15 hours after regeneration, I still can heal myself, grow another hand. My guess is that he could also send his regeneration energy to a butterfly, given that concept. So,
also before this had the concept of the Doctor just pulling out the regeneration energy to heal River's wrist. So
yeah, exactly.
I don't know. It's one of the few powers I don't enjoy the most.
But it's a power that, you know, it's been established and it already exists. So once they brought the Timeless Child in, it kind of made the Doctor overpowered, but it was ridiculous that the Doctor wasn't using it.
You have no consequences now.
Yeah. It was kind of like so the Doctor's got this great power to save people and doesn't.
I have a prediction that he's going to save this butterfly and let a lot of just people die over the course of this next season.
That's the problem that you're going to have with that, is that now you have to go and heal everybody at every single point in the whole program.
Yeah, but that was a problem that got introduced when the Timeless Child became a thing. That wasn't really a fault with this episode. That was a fault from previously.
Yeah, I think the best steel man of this is saying, like, oh, he was using it to rewrite the timeline as it always should be. And all those other times where we're going to see this person die and not be brought back to life, it was as the timeline wanted it to be.
Time out. Now, here's a thought, though. Just a simple thought. Does this mean that humanity is not a fixed point in time and space? Because if all of a sudden you could step on a butterfly and change all how time worked from that point, that would mean that all those other fixed points in time and space aren't really that fixed anymore.
All that fixed to me. Yeah. And if they are, I mean, we just ignore the rules, you know, every few episodes or so for the sake of plot.
I think it means that, you know, humanity's history is going to follow a very similar pattern regardless of the genetics involved. Mm-hmm. Because she looked totally different and was acting very different, but she still went through her life to the point where the Doctor picked her up and she still seemed
And let's be real, for all that difference in evolutionary background, she looked pretty darn similar.
Yeah.
There was some similarities, definitely.
I wonder if that means that she truly is human.
Hmm. Although, back to the
I think she is a human.
Yeah, I didn't...
There was a name drop, and I wanted to know if anyone else... Oh, well, it... Shoot. Never mind. I can't talk about it this episode.
What?
Well, no. Back to the whole regeneration.
Okay, hang on. We all agreed that we were going to just watch the one episode and then podcast and then watch the second one. It sounds like everyone here except for Colin and me watched both the episodes.
All I'm going to say is if I have to go to the beginning of this episode, the doctor starts off with a very odd speech. And granted, I know that when a new companion comes on board the TARDIS, he kind of has to give a rundown of who he is, what he is, and all that. I felt that it was a little clunky.
And a little bit, like, redundant, because hasn't he already had this conversation with Ruby?
Yeah, it also felt kind of like Ruby was just kind of rehashing all, like, the Rose lines, you know, like, the same.
It was very much, it reminded me a lot of just, like, Eccleston being in to explain everything to Rose and all this other fun stuff.
Well, to be fair, they are introducing it to a whole new audience on Disney Plus. On Disney Plus.
Barely.
No, actually, there is quite a few people on
Disney. There are quite a few episodes of Doctor Who on Disney Plus before this season.
Only three.
Yeah, but like it's kind of, you needed
new
to
ones,
watch the rest
maybe.
Of the ones. The
right,
but series. But like, back to the whole regeneration thing, I think they could pretty easily explain it away. Like, the Doctor said, yeah, I can give you my regeneration energy, but like I might lose an arm or a few legs in the future regeneration. So maybe it'll heavily disfigure.
No, because that goes away with the fact that the Doctor has infinite regeneration
does
energy.
Does it, though? Because like, assumably it takes from his next couple of regenerations, and it could...
But then,
it's infinite,
if
like,
it's
why
infinite,
it
so he could... You know, if you take something away from infinity, what do you have left?
You jump off a few cliffs, you're back to normal, better than ever.
Right, but, like, what if it could be explained that it, like, I guess splices his genes, and then it, like, he becomes a different species almost.
Part butterfly?
In other words, there's a chance that there's a limitation to how the Doctor physically can use his regeneration energy versus the fact that he can use his regeneration energy.
Well, let's hope so, and let's hope it's a good justification, because it seems like they're flying blind. Let's be real.
Yeah.
And these were mistakes.
And I'm going to say this part. I understand that this is just a fun show we're all watching and everything else. I just find that sometimes people in the Doctor Who universe, or in the production crew...
We don't take this too seriously!
Not you. I'm talking about... Some people say, like, there's an overarching element and everything has to be followed, but then they find moments where they just want to change things and they won't act as though they just did that.
Well, that's nice. You just, like, you know, when you change things, like, sometimes you smuggle in a lot of consequences, and I feel like it can cheapen some things.
Mm-hmm. That's a problem
or,
with
you
canon.
You know, make some decisions not so savory. If anything, like, it adds more credence to our hypothesis of maybe the Doctor's a villain if he doesn't want to heal all these people that are dying and suffering.
Yeah, though I have to wonder what the butterfly compensation switch does exactly, because, like, does it just remove the butterfly effect from the entirety of the time-traveling experience? Is, like, nothing... Like, this is a safe simulation of a time stream and that it can't be altered in any way? Or, like, what? How does that work exactly?
It's a good question. It feels like, honestly, most of Doctor Who that I'm familiar with, like, throws chaos theory out of the window. Like, it's very hard to make one little change and make it be that radical to change all of evolution.
I think that's the problem when you have multiple writers for a show that's 60 years old, is that you've got two... You're going to have a writer that's not necessarily going to go back to the Time Monster to figure out what happened to Atlantis in the Time Monster. They may write a completely different story about Atlantis. And let me just say this. The Doctor has visited Atlantis in multiple stories, and in each case... Other things have happened to Atlantis that didn't happen in the previous story, so
they weren't fixed points.
Fixed points, or they're just lots of realities that the Doctor's visiting. But that kind of goes against
Atlantis in another universe, maybe.
But that goes against the rise of the Cybermen. So I mean, the point is that you've got so many different canonical ideals or ideas. And trying to fit them all together as a puzzle is a bit difficult. Going back to the example of unit dating, nobody knows what the hell's going on with the Brigadier and unit because They claim
didn't know they were dating.
Yeah, me neither. I was really shocked about this.
But they're supposed to be taking place in the 80s, but then in the Fifth Doctor era, the Brigadier retires in 1977. So how in the world does that work?
You know what? You're right. There's a lot of balls to juggle there. You know what's really easy to juggle in your mind?
What?
Knowing how capable babies are.
Yes, there we go. I was waiting. I admit, this was my fault we went on this tangent, but...
Before we get to the babies, I think we should get back to the Ruby and the Doctors, because when they first land on the spaceship, they have a moment that's exactly just like we had talked about with their conversation on board the TARDIS. They have the moment where he presents the phone to Ruby so she can call her mom.
Mm-hmm.
This is very, very reminiscent on the end of the world.
Very Rose-like, like what I was saying before.
Exactly.
Like it's,
she
know,
even
it's
looks
like,
a
oh,
lot like Rose.
She does as well. Very rose-coated.
And so I don't know if that's Russell trying to bring in this new Disney audience, if he's trying, or if he's just trying to have the parallels for the old-school fans so he can go, hey, this looks familiar.
Well, what was kind of nice about what they did differently in this one than like what we've normally had with companions is that like the Doctor is just like upfront with her, is like, this is who I am, this is all my emotional baggage, here's the deal. And then like Ruby's going home like, yeah mom, I'm going wandering around through time and space with this guy, the Doctor. And it's just like, it's kind of refreshing to not have any of the unnecessary secrecy that's always built into shows
walking
like this.
Around
like, yeah,
yep.
Like here they're just like, yep, this is what's up. So it's kind of refreshing having the Doctor be like that and the companion also be like that. And
but
kinda,
but
yeah.
Also to contrast her from Rose, she's very gung-ho and like, hey, I like this idea, even though she really still has no clue who this guy is. If you take Eccleston's Doctor, and I know I've talked about this with you, Jeremy, earlier. If you take Eccleston's Doctor, he just came out of the Time War. And he was kind of brooding. He was still kind of reeling from that whole part of his life. You've got a new Doctor that is extremely vibrant and happy and go-lucky and trying to look for something new. That's going to be – that charisma that he – and that joy that he has is probably contagious and allows him to be more trustworthy towards a companion who has no idea who he is and was like, okay, sure, I'll follow you into the TARDIS. Why not?
Yeah, but I also just think that the Doctor in general has been pretty dodgy about his history and who he is, like, even before the Time War. And I think that it's just like, this one was just like, yeah, I'm done with that.
He obviously meditated for quite a long time because he's grown as an individual. Jumping to the year, instead of like, what, 15 Apple A million billion, whatever the year was, with rose to like 21,056. But they totally referenced Star Trek and like visiting Star Trek within that episode initially. Mm-hmm. Like, that's not just a throwaway line, is it? He totally said, yeah, we need to go visit them one day.
Yeah, they're poaching the sci-fi fans. They're trying to bring them in. Although
Yeah, Disney does not own Star Trek yet, so
we cannot
say for sure.
By the way, I want to say one thing about our most recent Doctor. He can fly that TARDIS.
Yeah, really.
He's like, bam, bam, land.
Although we are kind of crashing a few more times lately than we were before.
Yeah, I mean,
but
is it a new TARDIS?
He lands.
Yeah.
I mean, it might be a brand new TARDIS. Like, it's hard to say which one is which, what...
I don't know.
All I'm going to say is he lands it with confidence.
I will say what was interesting about that is he sort of turned what looked to be like an anti-grav switch on just to avoid the TARDIS shaking so much, because that was a thing from before. It's like such a clunky time machine, but like if you implement just the simple design of the compensation switch, which I'm guessing maybe River Song... with the blue button of boringness maybe helped him with that decision. But, like, he totally... I don't know, what was the effect? It kind of...
She turned the brakes off.
Right, but it was...
Parking brakes.
It was outside of the spaceship, and then it sort of went into it, not just normally materializing there. It just sort of, like, was shifting... in space and time, but like
phase shift.
Yeah, it was weirder though, like with this, because it was reminiscent of that time, the Christmas special that introduced David Tennant, where it was sort of going really quickly through time, and it phased all the way and crashed on Earth.
I also was wondering why they lost gravity inside the TARDIS when the Doctor was flying Ruby for the first time. That was kind of interesting.
I think it'd be a fun effect to show.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, obviously, but I mean, why?
I don't know why we needed to see the blow the nose sequence twice. I think we could have trusted the audience to remember, you know, how the noses were blown and
can we talk about the babies?
Yeah, let's talk about babies.
Did you actually get to the main part of the plot?
All right, main part of the plot.
There's not much to say about the main part of the plot.
Babies are taking care of themselves
in space.
In space.
And they've been doing it for a few years now.
For six years. And are all still babies.
Which tells me that there's like some sort of isolation thing going on there with not letting them grow up till they land.
Well, the weird thing is that like if they just made the kids like six, then the stuff they were doing like could be believable.
Oh, yeah.
But then like...
It seems like it could probably be pretty cute too.
If you have to CGI babies doing things, then that should be a clue that babies can't do those things and you shouldn't...
I think the other problem was that their mouths didn't quite work with the dialogue. And one of the problems I had was that the voices didn't sound like what I would imagine them sounding like
and,
in the first place.
Okay.
They sound like human adults and not babies.
I mean, also, like, the one baby that was, like, the main baby that had a crush on Ruby and everything, like, man, that thing had resting brat face.
Right.
Like, the entire time, it was like, why did you choose that one?
I know.
Like, literally
that's
any other
baby.
Yeah, well, but, like, Eric sort of had that sort of just, like, blank stare look, and then...
I don't know, why do we do this at all? Like,
just make them normal 6-year-olds.
So, yeah, who's asking for, guess who's talking 4 or 5?
Okay,
like,
but it does relate to Ruby in the way that it obviously...
She's around babies a lot, and
yeah,
she's good at holding babies.
Right,
she seems
like,
motherly.
Right, well, but, like, there's almost an amount of coincidence surrounding her and babies that have been led up to this far.
And it's nice that they brought it up, because that means it's going to be part of the plot rather than just something they accidentally did.
Right. Now, I wanted to talk...
This doesn't get me excited for more babies.
No.
You want to address the bogeyman in the room?
Jeremy, get out of my head, okay? No, I want to talk about how they did this neat thing of having this whole... They did an Aliens riff, right? With this one, like having the...
Yeah, the character was... The evil guy was definitely Alien.
Aliens riff. And that whole element of making it creepy monster, and then when she get the reveal of it is the literal bogeyman, I don't know. That's one of those moments when that's a Doctor Who moment that can just make you smile a little bit.
It didn't make me smile.
Like
I thought it was dumb.
I feel like it made me roll my eyes, look down at the ground,
I love the stupidity of it. I love the stupidity of it.
Right. Well, so what was interesting was...
I would have thought you'd love the Chibnall era if you love stupid episodes.
There was an interesting line where the Doctor did address to Ruby, there's no such thing as monsters, just creatures you haven't met yet. Which is a running theme, and that sort of ties into what happens later on in the story where he decides to save the monster but like at the same time the monster was built up incorrectly. We weren't set any stakes besides it's scary, it growled at 17 hertz, it's scaring the children, they're afraid of it, and they called it the bogeyman.
The Doctor got a bad vibe from it for sure,
and he was confused by that.
That part was good, but I think the other problem that I have with the bogeyman is that we didn't actually have any emotional impact on this. If you go back to the Star Whale from the Matt Smith era, we actually felt for that thing. We had a lot of references and a lot of reasons to feel bad for it. There's a few episodes in the past that we've had that, but in this case, they didn't build the bogeyman up as a character that you would actually feel anything for.
Or that you would feel danger from, either. Like, it didn't seem like there were stakes.
Yeah, it was fully isolated, you know? It's like, oh, yeah.
It kind of seemed like, if we just don't go there, then it won't be a problem.
It looks scary, so that's probably the main reason why it felt scary for the people for the kids and for the Doctor and all that.
Yeah, but I mean, if it was scary and that fear prevented you from doing things repeatedly throughout the episode, that would be, you know, one thing, but this was just like, we eventually have to get back to the TARDIS, so, you know, we'll probably have to face this thing.
What was interesting was the dialogue exchange with Ruby and the Doctor. The Doctor sort of built up pushing buttons. I feel like it was a little contrived in this episode, but it sort of just was there. But besides that, he said that there was like a species that they go gung-ho enough and band kissing and then set up all these baby farms to basically control the population. And you have to wonder, if you look like a little deeper into it, what that would mean. Like, do you selectively make random gene splices, or do you like, I don't know, breed very specific kinds of babies with traits that you want them to have, or like all the different kinds
of options?
There's a lot of options.
I assume it wouldn't be random.
Well, if the computer can take a fictitious monster and create it, then I'm sure the computer can also create just about any child it would wish, based on whatever DNA it has on stock.
Do you want a brave baby to go down and shoot a flamethrower?
Yeah.
Do you want a more timid baby to, you know, take care of its own nature and stay away from danger?
Where did they
or
get
lead?
That flamethrower in the first place? Like, that's a little irresponsible.
It seems like it was just a button that comes with, you know, baby sitting chairs. That
yeah.
They could just,
and also, it just didn't make sense. Just like the whole concept of the computer creating this monster.
Fictitious monster.
Like, did that
make
sense at all to anyone?
Actually, it didn't make sense to me, especially when we realized that the nanny was...
Jocelyn.
Yeah, a person.
Yeah.
And, like, but did she didn't...
Not
what?
Very great nanny, as far as I can...
Well, she was, like, an accountant that
yeah, no,
just
no,
got stuck with
admittedly,
the
admittedly, that is... what Jocelyn, I felt, was okay written in some ways. Like, she was a fine character in the sense that she's, like... the only thing that I would say is, like, she showed that accountants can have hearts, too.
Yeah, except she's not going anywhere near any babies. She's not touching them.
Yeah,
she's
been there for 6 years and has never hugged these kids.
I mean, it sounds like a child abuser
like
to me.
Was, that was,
sounds like child
I said,
abuse.
I said the, probably one of the better written, but not the best. Nothing in this one. Okay.
Well, she said that she didn't want to see them die, and she didn't want them to see her die.
Which is, I think, that's why there's no six-year-olds.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But, like, it was still a little weird.
A great caretaker, right? Like, objectively so? Like, doesn't it seem that way?
A lot of unexplained stuff that is in this episode that kind of detracts from the plot. And I'll admit, this is a first episode. Typically, first episodes are fun romps. They don't typically...
It feels like a second episode.
This is actually
yeah.
a second
yeah.
episode.
A lot of people even think it's a middle-of-the-season kind of filler episode kind of thing.
Yeah,
so
it's
a lot
not
of people
a very good one.
A reboot, you know.
And there's so much repetition between the Church on Ruby Road and this one with the babies and with the introduction of the Doctor to Ruby and all that other stuff. I will say, though, there is a really amazing scene in this, and I think it's definitely between the Doctor and the Captain, who I thought was really cute. but when the Doctor goes to her and she's, like, questioning, did we grow wrong? Are we wrong? Are we incorrect?
Mm-hmm.
And is questioning her even existence. And the Doctor gets into that kind of sweet, tender moment where he's just like, no, there are no wrong people. You're unique to the universe. That's something that I've always told people, is that everybody out there is unique to the universe. There is never going to be another you. And to see the Doctor kind of embrace that tenfold, which the Doctor typically does, including back at the Christmas Carol when he...
Or Rings of
Akatan.
He's
a
great
speech
with that.
I can get that sentiment.
Yeah.
I like it too, but at the same time, it kind of feels like... It's like if I go up to you and Michael say, like, Michael, is there something wrong with the way that I'm living my life and how I am? It's like, no, everybody's doing the right thing and everybody's fine. Like, it kind of, like, cheapens it. Like, it almost makes me feel like, you can't be wrong. Don't worry about being wrong because everybody's the same.
I don't think
it's
about...
you're not doing worse than anyone.
It's not about how you live your life. It was more like it's the stuff that they couldn't control. It's like it's kind of a reflection on if you have a certain culture, a certain race, a certain religion, a certain ethnic background.
Yeah, but you're always holding something that you can control, where you control nothing. You know,
right, but that's where I think the Doctor was trying to go with that. He's trying to explain that you can't control the fact that you're still in a child, in a baby's body, even though you're 6 years old. I think that's where he was going with that, and I don't think he was trying to say. Because he was also
right. That's the best way to interpret it, and I think it's the best way for the story. But it feels like a moment of like, am I okay? Am I good enough? Don't worry, everybody's good enough.
They were doing a pretty good job keeping themselves alive.
So Colin, this is more or less like it's one of the Doctor's main themes, and throughout all things is that. You know, humanity is a precious thing. It's a wonderful thing. People being born and everything else, that's a great thing. And these children were basically saying, am I being here? Am I the problem? And to that, he's like, no, you're perfect. Because the whole thing was that this is about the reason they did the babies. And I know there's a lot of shoehorn in concepts, was the idea of being born as a refugee in this scenario does not make you a bad person, which is, and this time is timely and a good message is basically what it was built around. I feel, Russell T. Davis said, "Tell me if I'm wrong."
No, you're right, and it really is a message speaking out to everyone rather than this one baby. But it feels like if you're talking about these certain babies and they're worried about their self-worth, you bring up their specific positive attributes rather than you say, "Don't even worry about that because no one needs to worry about that."
Right. Well, I think there's a deeper subtext. I mean, it's sort of like almost obvious, but it's like the whole abortion and adoption. Debate, like sort of keeping around babies but no one's taking care of them, what are we doing? And it was interesting that they mentioned that the planet was set like precedent that these babies had to keep going despite no one being there to take for them or to care for them, and that all these people were signing off they didn't want to, but like they had to sign off. What I thought would have been interesting was like if those people, instead of signing off, encountered the boogeyman, and that's when it became a problem and some of them like died or something, or like that would have made new stakes appear in this story, because you would have been able to tell what happens when you encounter the boogeyman, because basically as it is, the boogeyman didn't do anything yet. So you have no expectations, no emotional attachment, or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
But the scene right after the whole baby incident was that the snow came through after the Doctor remembered the whole mother thing.
That was a good scene, actually.
But what was interesting, it was in the background the whole time, out of focus, it was sort of given a little part, was like there was a drawing on the wall that kind of looked like a weird, creepy, smiling sunflower kind of a thing. And I know Russell T. Davies really likes to put details like that in the first episodes to build up something that'll appear later on. And I feel like if you look back on this episode, you'll probably find one of those drawings to be referencing future encounters with creatures.
There's no bad wolves in this episode, I thought you were trying to say. I don't see it.
Yeah, no, none at all, actually.
They're just bad babies.
I do like the idea of Ruby kind of building up Eric, the one that falls in love with her, and how he goes and becomes brave and goes down to confront this creature that's down there, and then gets really scared and then runs away and tries to change his own nappy by hiding. I love the fact that Ruby takes responsibility for her actions and realizes she's the one that inspired him to go down there in the first place. And it's not the Doctor that runs down there first, it's Ruby.
Yeah, well, I mean, and it makes sense because she was always encouraging her mom to adopt more kids and taking care of them and everything.
Exactly.
And
but
she was one of them. She sees the value, you know, in babies and especially ones that are abandoned by parents.
But I just thought that was a really cool scene. Not every companion in their first adventure with the Doctor actually
for a second
will be that bold in running towards danger.
Yeah, I don't think it's fair to call this the first adventure.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's clear like that, you know, it was already clear that she's going to run towards danger to save a baby. Especially as one that she has a connection with.
Although
that was solidified in the last one that we watched with Ruby.
Mm-hmm. True, good point.
I will have to say, with Eric confronting the monster at the time, everyone was so scared of it initially. They were like, "That's the bogeyman. We're scared of the bogeyman." And then just like almost the throwaway line that Ruby said, "It doesn't exist." But even so, like they saw it. Like so, Eric's thought process was, I'll go down there and confront this thing despite it being scary. It just didn't make much sense to me, even though Ruby said, and he is a 6-year-old child at this point, that it doesn't exist. I don't see the connection. It just, like,
fear is a superpower. No.
It felt like it was just to get from A to B.
Yeah, there were a lot of things in this episode that felt like that.
Yeah.
Or it was like, what?
Yeah, I felt like a few moments where it's just like, it felt like they're not trusting the audience to hold some things in mind or to have key media literacy. Like, some things that felt like they were slapping me across the face with the points that they were trying to make.
Like
where it's just like, remember when they blew their noses? Remember? That's where this creature's from. It's like, you don't need to tell me that. I mean, you had the scene. We all remember it. We know.
I think the problem with this episode, and I think that it kind of goes to your point right now, is that they kind of dumbed it down, almost as if they're trying to go for a much younger audience.
They're trying to think that we're all babies.
Well, maybe that's where they're going with the program, because they're putting it on Disney. They're making it less adult, but
they're making it less science-y.
I mean, but here's the thing, is that the adipose weren't really all that different when we went with Partners in Crime. That was just about
as silly.
I mean,
if you're going to animate the whole thing, that's okay. If you're going to animate mouths, I have a jarring reaction.
And
oh, yes.
If they're aliens, then it's okay, whatever level of like development you want to give them. But if they're human babies, it's like, no, that's clearly wrong.
Yeah, it's
like
we
they could have
thrown
in a line of in there of like, oh yes, these genetically enhanced babies, these cybernetically augmented like babies, or whatever. Anything like that would have made this.
Yeah, but
much
also
more
I'm
palatable.
Not even sure if they are, because we see the Doctor talking to babies all the time, and with their Goo Goo Gaga's, the Doctor somehow like has very complex conversations
with
these babies. Like maybe babies in the Doctor Who universe really are just that complex. They're pretty much already 6-year-olds plus, and they always are. They kind of forget about it when they start to learn English.
Yeah, assumably they come from the planet Del Rio, and they speak like a Cantonese-like language. I just assumed it was the translation matrix of the TARDIS making things weird, like with the baby voices being like 6 years old. But we don't really know how these babies age in the first place, so that was another weird thing. But what was also interesting was the planet Monde Calhoun, which was a part of Duplessis Empire that takes in refugees. There's like an entire refugee planet out there, just a complete planet meant for refugees. I thought it was interesting because it was almost separated like another country. Like,
mm-hmm.
This is so far advanced in the future that we have entire planets meant for just like a cause. Like, donating $1 a day, that's that planet over there, that's the mac and cheese planet over here. It was like,
but Jeremy, I mean, that's just the shorthand of how you have a water planet, how you have a forest planet. In other sci-fi like things, like there's only one biome on these planets, and like then you always hear how this planet has 6 million people on it, like, and
I was like, don't most like I don't know, I'm not a planet scientist or anything, but it seems like a lot of them, if they're not in this grand magical Earth zone, probably do pretty much have one biome.
Yeah, but it's not for us.
Well, if
it's like completely inhabitable situation.
Yeah, just
Wisconsin, the state, is known for its cheese. that doesn't mean that Wisconsin only produces cheese.
What
so
else do they produce?
My point...
Dinosaurs.
My
butterfly
point,
people.
My point, though, is that maybe the planet is solely known for that one aspect of it. That doesn't mean that that's the only aspect. It's common that a lot of people would associate, like, France with one thing or Italy with one thing or just that one specific thing that just kind of reminds you of, oh, yeah, I remember that place has it.
It's only the Eiffel Tower in Paris and nothing else.
Yeah. All right,
exactly.
Should we rate this episode?
Oh, sure. I can go first on this one.
Okay.
So, I'm probably going to surprise some people. My favorite thing about this episode was the name. And I just love the saying Space Babies. Because the way the Doctor said it, I just like the way he's like, Space Babies. I'm like, that's a great name. That's it. It had good themes. It had good heart. It had a lot of things that were good, and they were stitched together, and I could see all the stitches. And to me, that kind of weakens it. But is that the worst episode I've seen? It is not the worst story I've seen. So I have a hard time rating this above a 5. But I do think I'm hoping it is going to be the weakest episode of Doctor Who this series, or season. So, it's a 5.
Okay. Well, I feel like, it did have its ups and downs. Its downs definitely being the spoor that was everywhere. but I liked a few parts of it. Like, there's a bit of a poetic back and forth between Ruby and the Doctor, despite the whole spoor situation. Or, like, the Ruby was like, no, 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 and then the Doctor is like, no wonder, and then Ruby says, the Doctor says, it's not, and then the Ruby says, it's not. So there's, like, a different, like, a writing scheme that I thought was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The whole bogeyman getting ejected by Jocelyn and then the Doctor, it makes sense that the Doctor would be sort of not okay with that, since, you know, this is a species that hadn't done anything, but the kids were like, no, don't hurt it, well, before they were scared out of their minds and fought it off with the flamethrower. I feel like, you know, if they've gone as far as flamethrowing it, they wouldn't mind it being ejected, so it was a little contrived there. It howled like a wolf, which was weird, and there's a lot of low humor, but And Ruby did get a key really quickly, I think. Because, like, they'd only known each other for a day or so, and then suddenly it's like terms and conditions, can't go back in time, which I guess he learned from Rose. He learned a lot of things from Rose, which he then improved on this one. And then I guess the last thing that was interesting was the Doctor teasing sort of his name at the very end of the story. Like... off screen, which was a little odd, but I would have to say, if I had to rate it, I'd probably rate it higher than a 5. Personally, I'd probably rate it just above the Christmas story that came before it, which would be about a 6.2.
I'll jump into this. So there are some things to love about this episode. I think one of the biggest saving graces is the relationship between the Doctor and Ruby. Great charisma. I'm really excited to see these two move into the future and see them just banter. I feel like if we just had a banter episode going with some dinosaurs, I think this might have been more successful. I like a lot of origin stories, and while this is part 2, we got some origins in the beginning. They were fun to work through, but it feels like a copy-paste of Rose.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like the Doctor's like, oh, another attractive blonde girl. We can treat her the same. So, and, you know, from there... You know, I don't see a lot of magic here. Space Babies, while a good name, I don't think makes for a good episode. It seems very tropey. It feels very done before. It doesn't feel like there's a good reason for them. There's not much explanation for them. Going from bit to bit to the plot, I never really cared about them. As far as I'm concerned, shoot the babies into space, keep the boogeyman.
Wow.
Oh. Yeah, I don't think the nanny was great. I don't think the storytelling was great. And I think Russell T. Davies made a bad decision putting this episode, you know, at the forefront. For me, it's getting a 3 out of 10.
I thought I was alone.
Yeah, I, you know, yeah, I agree with a lot of what was said. You know, there was some good stuff between the Doctor and Ruby, but all together, the episode really kind of fell apart, and I had a lot higher expectations of Russell T. Davies after, you know, everything he's done before. And, you know, to put in perspective, honestly, I think I should have been rating episodes lower over the previous several seasons. But, yeah, but just on this one, trying to rate it properly, yeah, I'm going to give this one a 4. There was just a lot of it that was just like, what? And also, why?
Yeah, a lot of whys. I would say that for this particular story, I think the one thing that holds it together is Ruby and the Doctor. They have extreme chemistry. The Doctor's charisma plays off her young, kind of vibrant self, and that is beautiful. I like seeing that. I hope that they continue that. With that said, I think there... I did actually care for some of the kids, but that's probably because I'm a father and I was a teacher, so both of those things kind of help that quite a bit. I do like a lot of the interactions that some of the kids had with the Doctor, and they did seem to get a little bit better with the mouth to speech with the babies. But whose bright idea to work with babies at this extent of a level? Just if it was Russell T. Davies, I appreciate the idea, but it's probably the worst concept that one could actually go with. Because working with babies, in even in a theatrical sense, it's kind of like working with cats. You're just not going to get them to do what you need them to do, so you're going to have a heck of a lot of patience. Fortunately, they had about a year and a half before they had to show this episode, since they've actually filmed it.
Man, they had a year and a half to decide not to air this one.
Disney money made that special effects, though.
I think the plot was pretty straightforward. I don't think there really was anything that was
interesting about it. Oh, sorry. Yeah.
I don't think there was... It wasn't convoluted. It wasn't a typical Stephen Moffat-type plot or anything. But it wasn't... But it was pretty obvious that what the plot was. But with that said, it wasn't executed well. And that's where I think the problem lies. The director may not have known what to do with everything that was going on. Visually stunning, the music in this episode great. They even had a callback to the This Is Gallifrey theme from the 10th Doctor era. I thought that was beautiful, so that was nice. But I'm giving this story a 4.5 out of 10.
You gave the Boogers story a visually appealing. No, visually stunning.
Well, I would say that I'm saying the outer space scenes, actually the costuming for the boogeyman was actually pretty decent.
I think it was a good creature of the week in terms of look, for sure.
Yeah, no, I think they did a good job. They didn't really also hold a whole lot of time on the creature, so your imagination could kind of fill in the gaps here and there. And all that spludge that was coming off of it when the airlock was opened, well, that was kind of gross too. But it just... I know, I kind of see where they were trying to go with this story, and they just didn't make it. They didn't. They fell short by at least half the track.
Yeah, and the low rating for me may be like by like, you know, an expectation mishap too, because I was really pumped for this season.
Yeah,
I saw a lot of good things going down, especially after the first episode, which wasn't perfect by any means, but we saw that chemistry.
Yeah,
and we see it here again, but like, I thought the writing would be fixed, and it felt like it really fell flat. Like,
yeah.
If you were looking for me to jump on, sink my teeth into it, and get back into it...
It fell out of
like,
space.
Like, if I wasn't on the podcast, I might not be watching the next episode.
You know, and I'm just going to say, even though they called it out, but just two baby episodes in a row, is this...
I think this may be why they released two episodes at once, because maybe they realized that this particular episode was a weaker one. Maybe they just felt like, okay, we need to release two of them so they know that this isn't the only thing we're doing. And here's
all right,
the thing.
Well, then maybe we should go find out what they do next.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, we've had Doctor Light stories, we've had Companion Light stories. This time it was a Story Light story.
All right, bye everyone.
Bye. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.